Okay, this is our podcast on Rabindranath Tagore's short story, Punishment. Lots of people read this text as a commentary on, as a social realistic text, commentary on the role and position of women in contemporary Indian society, where when Tagore is writing at the early 20th century. And yes, you can read it that way, but that's a pretty simplistic reading, I think. I think what he's got going on here is a big allegory for the rush for Indian independence. Tagore, as if you looked at the biographical information, Tagore was very active in the Satyagraha movement, Gandhi's drive for Indian independence. In fact, you could say that he's the guy who convinced Gandhi that they'd never get independence unless both Hindus and Muslims were involved. Gandhi didn't want to have Muslims involved in the movement, in the independence movement. But he eventually convinced, Tagore eventually convinced Gandhi to get Subhanra Bose involved as the leader of the big Muslim movement. And it wasn't until that happened that they were successful. Unfortunately, neither of them lived to see Indian independence, but that's almost beside the point there. But I think if we take a look at the story, what we've got going on here is, yes, you can see the social realism and just how difficult it is to eke out a living as essentially a tenant farmer, as a sharecropper for a landlord. These two brothers spent the day not working their own fields, not working the fields they rented, but working the landlord's fields. So it's a kind of a double condemnation for them. They not only lose a day of working their own fields, but they give that day to somebody else and they don't get paid. And these two brothers, you couldn't have more opposite people, right? It's, if you know of Mice and Men, it's George and Lenny. But it's, in actuality, you know, Cheatham is look at how he's constantly described in this text as tight, compact, muscular. All the women love him, right? And his brother, not so much, right? Kind of big, kind of oafish, a little slow, not a real good thinker, right? And they're both married, right? Cheatham is married to Chandara, who suits him just fine, right? She's just as good looking as he is. You know, there's that line there when she goes to the village well to get water, all the men in the village notice, right? That starts out okay, but then they both grow to become pretty jealous of one another. Their relationship is pretty contentious. Dukiram, Cheatham's brother, has a wife also, Radha. She doesn't have a big part in the story, but she's more or less kind of the MacGuffin for the story here, right? She gives as good as she gets. She and Chandara don't get along. She and Duki, let's face it, don't really get along. That's pretty obvious as well. So Duki and Cheatham are out on this particular day that where the story begins, working the landlord's fields. Duki comes home and he's hungry and basically says, make me a sandwich. Radha says, well, you know what? I'd make you a sandwich if you brought anything home to eat. Well, this enrages Duki. He goes off the handle. And he, as Tagore says, he stabs her in the head. And I think he's being a little coy there because really, he's a farmer. He's got this big knife. He's not stabbing her in the head. He's not putting this blade through her skull. He's probably putting it through her eyeball. And Tagore doesn't want us to get caught up in kind of the grossness of that image there. But what he's done is right, he's killed his wife. And then the real incident of this, although that's a great incident, right? The real incident of the story happens with what Cheatham does. Cheatham asks Chandara to take the blame for this murder. And in an instant, Chandara basically says yes, she will. And the great puzzle of this question, or the great puzzle of the story is why? Why would you take the rap for this? Right? And the kind of the delicious twist of this is By the time we get to the end of the story and we're in the courtroom, Cheatham and Dookie try to tell him the truth. Rom Loken basically doesn't really, right? He's not sure what's going on, but he realizes he's got to, you know, he's got to cut his losses. And so he just tells exactly what he knows in the courtroom. But by the time they get to the courtroom and they realize that Chandara is willing to die for this, and they don't know why, she's not letting him, in fact, basically she lies in order to keep this going. When the brothers tell the truth, it looks like a lie. Nobody believes them. Psychologically, there's a connection with this. The idea that in a sick situation, the healthy choice is the thing that looks sick. So that's kind of the same thing that's going on here, except this is a really extreme choice. It's the notion of she'd rather die than live another day the way she's living. And it's not just because she's a woman and not just because they are definitely poor and not just because, it's all of these things, and not just because the way her husband treats her, it's all of these things put together that makes this problematic. And Chandara just says, listen, things aren't going to change until you're willing to die for them. And I think that's that kind of big puzzle is the thing that leads us to the idea of this is one of Tagore's kind of allegories for the Satyagraha movement, right? This insistence on the truth, as if you've read the biographical stuff, right? And you think about kind of the things that Gandhi, if you look at those lots of any crowd pictures of Gandhi in the 20s and 30s, really you see Tagore right alongside with him, right? Especially pictures of the Salt March happening in 1930. And then, you know, even later on, you know, you've got, because Tagore, although he didn't, you know, although he knew what side his bread was buttered on, he was certainly a member of the upper caste, the Brahmin caste, the upper class there. He didn't let that kind of get in the way of his patriotism, nationalism, I don't know what you want to call it, his concern for those who didn't have what he had, let's call it, right? And so what you get is this massive, in terms of Chandara, this massive non-cooperation up to death. And the best image I can think of that is, you know, when the British ruled India, the way British troops got around, the way they enforced their rule was, well, their tagline for the Raj was put a brown face on white justice. Basically, train up all the smartest Indian kids, bring them over to you know, suck them up into the bowels of the mothership, send them over to London, to England, and get trained up, send them back to run to administer the colony for us, and then we get to be the good guys. The white people get to be the good guys because they're going to basically come in and bend the rules if they want to, or enforce the rules if they want to, right? But it looks like the rules are all being done and made by Indians. The Satyagraha movements go against this, right? And they say, we're just not going to cooperate. We're not going to violently fight you because there's no way we can win. I mean, the reason why these places like, well, let's see, the United States or Ireland or even still Northern Ireland or Wales or Scotland or India or Rhodesia, why, or South Africa, the way they all get to be colonies is because of, well, see, there's this four-step process in colonization that's pretty endemic throughout the entire colonial cycle, right? The first move is always, and it's going to sound like a weird one, it's always a religious move. It's the missionaries. Missionaries are essentially the shock troops of empire, or the marines of empire. They're the ones who land on the beaches first. And what are they doing? They're bringing Christianity. Are they bringing a Christianity that says defend yourself against all comers? Are they bringing a Christianity that says, oh, our you know, the main man in our religion says, I come not to bring peace but the sword. I come to pit father against son. Nope. They're bringing, you know, Blake's the lamb. They're bringing submit to righteous authority. They're bringing, you know, will we not wreck his rod? You know, the Lord is my shepherd with his rod and his staff, so he beats me when he has to, right? That's the kind of religion they're bringing. And if I'm, let's say, the king of a colonizing country, I love missionaries. Because you know what they cost me? Nothing. In fact, it's their job to go out there. Some religious group or another pays them. Some church, some denomination pays these people to go out there and soften up the land for me to take over. And then I send over, after a few years, I send over, well, it's these two moves alternate, but the first move is always trade, because that's really what I want from a colony. So the first move is missionary, the second move is trade. And it's this economic activity. Look what we will give you if you just give us this stuff you got so much of. Spices, silk, tea, platinum, diamonds, gold, coal, you name it, we'll take it. And we'll give you these lovely things. Think back to the United States when the Dutch first landed here, right? The most densely populated spot in the United States, the most expensive real estate in the world, Manhattan, New York, was originally bought, the entire island, for $24 worth of glass beads and trinkets from Peter Minuit, who traded with the Indians and got it for 24 bucks. Got the entire island. Right? This is the economic move in the colonial process. Trade with us. We'll give you these lovely things. Oh, you have cowrie shells? We'll take those and we'll give you this stuff. Oh, you have, tea. No, you don't have tea? We'll teach you how to grow tea. We like tea. We'll teach you how to grow it. You got really fertile soil. You got lots of people to do the work. We'll teach you how to do that. You got cotton? We'll do that. Oh, you got slaves? Hey, we'll take them too. So that second move is always economic. Right? And it looks good to the person being colonized, to the group being colonized, because look what we're getting. This stuff that we don't really use for ourselves anyway. And then the third move is cultural. Well, now that you believe like us, or at least are trying to, and now that you kind of trade with us and spend with us, don't you want to live like us? Look what we got. We got houses. We got streets, we got buggies, we got horses, we got culture, we got museums. Look at all this cool stuff, all you primitive people. Don't you want to do this? Don't you want to mimic us? Don't you want to act just like us? Well, listen, we can let you do that. It's going to cost you a little bit, but we can let you do that. And so, right, the colonizer creates mimics of the colonized, right? They all try to act like the colonizer, right? And they're all judged by Western European values, white Western European values, white male Western European values. They're constantly judged by that, right? Because that, of course, as the Western European males see themselves, they're the height of civilization. All evolution has led to them. This is where they're headed to. So after this, right? There is one more option and one more move. But believe me, it's the iron fist in the velvet glove. And as the colonizer, I'm telling you, you don't want me to use this, right? I got three really nice things for you, right? I got religion, I got economics, I got culture. Don't make me use the thing that really sits at the root of all this. See, you guys got like bows and arrows and stuff like that, flaming torches. Yeah, you guess what I got? I got muskets. I got blunderbusses. I got artillery. I got infantry. I got cavalry. I have military might, and that's the fourth move, right? I don't want to use that. You know why? As the king of the colonizers, I don't want to use that, because then you're not a colony anymore. You're just an occupied country, and I got to expend resources, paying all those troops and supplying all those troops and everything. I don't want to have to do that. because the only reason colonies exist is because you guys are going to make me money. Right? I am going to make money on every trade with you. I'm going to make money on the slaves I get from you. I'm going to make money throughout this entire colonial process. So I'm not going to do that. I don't. And believe me, you don't want me to do that. And believe me, I'm not afraid to use it. You've heard of me. You know I'll use it. You've seen me use it. My military technology is so much more advanced than yours that I will definitely use it. You know, we see this in Candide. We're certainly seeing it here again in Tagore, right? What's the only way out? What's the only way to step out of this four-step process? Is that whole idea of non-cooperation. You are never going to beat the colonizer. The Indians are never going to beat the British through military might, through violence. Oh, there are plenty of attempts, just like there were plenty of attempts throughout Ireland to do that, just like there were a couple of attempts in the United States to do that before we finally succeeded. Civil disobedience, non-cooperation, satyagraha, these are the things that work. Oh, the British are using our railways to move their troops around? We're going to lay down on the tracks to make sure those troops don't move. And you know what happens? They get run over. These people do. And so the first person who lays down on the tracks to stop a troop ship from moving, that seems right. You're thinking they're not going to do it, and they do it. I think the bravest person is the second person who lays down on the track, knowing that they're willing to run you over, and yet you still do it. This is Chandara. This is Chandara, representative of all India. The only way to win the game is not to play. I'm not going to go along with the lies. I'm not going to go along with the power structure. I'm not going to do whatever it is you want me to do. And I will show you that even death is better than what I got now. Right? That's how firm I am in my convictions. Right? We know it from the Salt March. We know it from the civil disobedience. We know it from the non-cooperation, the fasting. Not so much from the constructive programs, because they really take a long time to ramp up. And the British, of course, aren't going to allow most of those to happen. But this is definitely, right? You can see that relationship there of the colonizer and the colonized in the relationship between Cheatham and Chandara, or between Chandara and the entire system that's set up, right? Her last words then, right? She finally gets to say it, right? Hell with him. Your husband wants to see you. She doesn't need to explain herself to her husband. She doesn't need to explain herself to her family or anything. To hell with him, right? I don't need to see him, right? This is the way I win. I don't play anymore. And it means that much to me, right? And to expand it, right, with satyagraha, if it means that much to so many people, that so many people are willing to lay down and die rather than participate in it, maybe we, the colonizers, should leave. It takes the Brits until 1947 to actually do it. But eventually, they get around to it, right? After World War II, they get around to it, they do it. Right? And it causes a whole nother set of problems. But they still get around to it. They do it. They realize that they will never break the will of those that they have colonized.